Chapter 36. The welcoming committee at Tabeza stayed home. Pitt and Giardino clearly didn't rate a reception by the local dignitaries. Two Tuaregs greeted them silently from behind automatic rifles as a third locked iron shackles around their hands and ankles. The worn condition of the chains and cuffs gave the impression they had passed through several owners. Pitt and Giardino were shoved roughly into the back of a small Renault truck. One Tuareg drove while the other two climbed in the back, held their rifles across their thighs, and kept wary eyes on the prisoners through the slit in their indigo lithium headdresses. Pitt paid the guards only the slightest attention as the engine was started and the truck moved away from the landing field. The helicopter that had flown them from Fort Fourreau quickly lifted into the furnace-baked air for its return flight. Already Pitt was weighing chances for escape. His eyes were studying the surrounding landscape. No fences stretched anywhere, no guardhouses rising from the sand. Any attempt to cross 400 kilometers of open desert while restrained by manacles made security obstacles entirely unnecessary. Successful escape seemed impossible, but he quickly thrust aside thoughts of total hopelessness. Prospects of escape were dim, but not totally gone. This was pure desert with not a growing thing in sight. Low brown dunes rose like warts as far as Pitt could see, separated by small valleys of brilliant white sand. Only toward the west did a high plateau of rock rise above the desert floor. It was treacherous country, and yet there was a beauty about it that was difficult to describe. It reminded Pitt of the background scenery in the old motion picture Song of the Desert. Sitting with his back against the side of the truck bed, he tilted his head and peered forward around the cab. The road, if it could be called that, was only tire tracks leading toward the plateau. No structures stood on the barren land. No equipment or vehicles were in evidence. No sign of ore tailings. He began to wonder if mining operations at Tabeza were a myth. Within 20 minutes the truck slowed, then turned into a narrow ravine cut into the plateau. So soft was the sand that had drifted into the deep-walled crack that prisoners and guards together had to get out and help push the truck to firmer ground. After nearly a kilometer, the driver swung into a cave just large enough for the truck to pass through. Then it entered a long gallery excavated in the rock. The driver braked the truck in front of a brightly lighted tunnel. The guards jumped out to the ground. Obeying the silent gestures of the gun muzzles, Pitt and Giardino awkwardly climbed down in their restricting shackles. The guards motioned them into the tunnel and they shuffled off, thankful to be out of the sun and in a cool underground atmosphere. The gallery became a corridor with fluted walls and a tile-glazed floor. They were marched past a series of arched openings cut into the rock and fitted with antique carved doors. The guards stopped at a large double door at the end of the corridor, opened it, and pushed them inside. Both men were surprised to find themselves standing on thick blue carpet in a reception room as luxurious as any inside a New York Fifth Avenue corporate executive's office. The walls were painted in a light blue to match the carpet and were decorated with photographs of breathtaking desert sunrises and sunsets. The lighting came from tall chrome lamps with soft gray shades. Directly in the center was an acacia desk with matching sofa and chairs in gray leather. In the rear corners, as though guarding a door to the sanctum sanctorum, stood two bronze sculptures of a Tuareg man and woman in proud poses. The air in the room was cool but not dank-smelling. Pitt was sure he detected a slight aroma of orange blossom. A woman sat behind the desk, quite beautiful with glowing purple-gray eyes and long black hair that fell to her buttocks behind the backrest of her chair. Her facial features were Mediterranean. Of exactly what national origin, Pitt was unable to tell. He looked up and studied the two men for a moment as nonchalantly as if she was classifying salesmen. Then she rose from a chair, revealing an hourglass body wrapped in a garment draped like an Indian sari, opened the door between the sculptures, and silently held out her hand for them to enter. They stepped into a large chamber with high-domed ceiling, lined on all four sides with bookshelves that were niched into solid rock. The entire room was one giant sculpture, chiseled as it was excavated. A huge horseshoe-shaped desk rose from the rock as if it was part of the floor. its top strewn with engineering diagrams and papers. The desk faced two long stone benches, separated by an intricately sculpted coffee table. Besides the books and desk litter, the only object not cut from rock was a wooden scale model of a mine gallery shored up with timbers that stood off to one side of the unusual room. An extremely tall man was standing in the far corner, absorbed in a book he had pulled from a shelf. He stood in a purple robe of the nomads with a white lithom bound around his head. Beneath his robe, a pair of snakeskin cowboy boots protruded incongruously. Pitt and Giordino stood there several moments before he turned and acknowledged their presence with a scant glance. Then his eyes flicked back to the pages of the book as if his visitors had turned around and departed. "Nice place you've got here," Giordino opened loudly, his voice echoing off the stone. "Must have cost you a bundle." "Could use some windows," Pitt said, surveying the bookcases. Then he looked up. "A stained glass skylight might help brighten up things a bit." O'Banion casually inserted the book between two volumes and stared at them with bemused curiosity. "You'd have to drill 120 meters through solid rock to reach the surface and sunlight. Not exactly worth the expense. I have more practical projects for my workers." "Don't you mean slaves?" said Pitt. O'Banion gave a slight lift to his shoulders. "Slaves, laborers, prisoners, they're all the same at Tabeza." He slid the book back on its shelf and approached them. Pitt had never stood that close to someone who stood almost two heads above him. He had to tilt his head sharply backward to stare up into his captor's eyes. "And we're the latest addition to your army of drones. As Mr. Massard no doubt informed you, digging in the mines is a less painful option than being tortured by General Kazim's thugs. You should consider yourselves thankful. I don't suppose there's any chance for parole, Mr. My name is Selig O'Banion. I manage the operation of the mine, and no, there is no parole. Once you come down into the pits, you will not come out." "Even for burial?" asked Giordino, without a hint of fear. "We have an underground vault for those who succumb," answered O'Banion. "You're as murderous as Kazim," said Pitt. "Maybe worse." "I've read of your undersea exploits, Mr. Pitt," O'Banion said, brushing off Pitt's insult. "It will be most enjoyable having another party whose intellect is on a level with mine. I found your reports on deep-sea mining of particular interest. You must dine with me from time to time and tell me of your underwater engineering operations." Pitt's face turned to ice. "Privileges so soon after incarceration? No thanks, I'd rather eat with a camel." O'Banion's lips bent minutely downward. "Suit yourself, Mr. Pitt. Perhaps you'll change your mind after a few days of working under Melika."
"Who?"
"My overseer. She has an uncommon cruel streak. You two are in good physical condition, so I'd estimate that when we next meet, she will have turned you into a pair of subdued vermin."
"A woman?" asked Giordino curiously.
"Like no woman you'll ever meet again." Pitt said nothing. The world knew of the notorious salt mines of the Sahara. They had become a byword for blue and white-collar workers everywhere as a job description. But a gold mine manned by slaves that was virtually unknown was a new twist. General Kazim, no doubt, had his hands in the profits, but the operation smelled like another venture of Yves Massard. The quasi-solar detoxification project and the gold mine, and God only knew what else. This was a big game, a game that stretched in all directions like octopus tentacles. An international game that spelled more than just money, but inconceivable power. O'Banion stepped over to his desk and pressed a button on a small console. The door opened, and the two guards walked into the room and stood behind Pitt and Giordino. Giordino glanced at Pitt, searching for a sign, a nod or movement of the eyes, signaling a coordinated attack on the guards. Giordino would have charged an oncoming rhino without hesitation if Pitt had given the word. But Pitt stood there stiffly, as if the feel of the manacles on his ankles and wrists had dulled his sense of survival. Somehow, above all else, he had to focus his wits on getting the secret of Fort Fourreau into Sandecker's hands, or die trying.
"I'd like to know who I'm working for," Pitt said.
"Didn't you know?" asked O'Banion dryly.
"Massard and his pal Kazim?"
"Two out of three, not bad."
"Who's the third?"
"Why, me, of course," O'Banion answered patiently.
A most satisfactory arrangement. Massard Enterprises provides the equipment and arranges for the sale of the gold. Kazim provides the labor, and I direct the mining and ore extraction operation, which is only fair since it was I who discovered the vein of gold.
What percentage do the Malian people receive?
Why, none, O'Banion said impassively.
What would a nation of beggars do with riches if they were dropped in their laps? Squander or be fleeced out of them by shrewd foreign businessmen who know every angle for taking advantage of impoverished peoples?
No, Mr. Pitt, the poor are better off poor.
Have you notified them of your philosophy?
O'Banion's expression was one of pure boredom.
What a dull world this would be if we were all rich.
Pitt plunged on. How many men die here in a year?
It varies. Sometimes 200, sometimes 3, depending on disease, epidemic, or mine accidents. I really don't keep count.
Amazing the workers don't strike, said Giordino idly.
No work, no food, O'Banion shrugged. And then Melica usually gets them moving by whipping the skin off the ringleaders.
I'm lousy with a pick and shovel, Giordino volunteered.
You'll quickly become expert. If not, or you cause trouble, you'll be transferred to the extraction section.
O'Banion paused to check his watch.
Still time for you to work a 15-hour shift.
We haven't eaten since yesterday, complained Pitt.
Nor will you eat today.
O'Banion nodded at the guards as he turned back to his bookshelves.
Take them.
The guards prodded them out. Apart from the receptionist and two men wearing tan coveralls and hard hats with miner's lamps, speaking in French and examining a piece of ore under a magnifying glass, there were no other people to be seen until they reached an office-type elevator with carpeted floor and chrome walls. The doors opened and the operator, a Tuareg, motioned them inside. The doors rattled shut and the hum of machinery reverberated off the walls of the shaft as they descended. The elevator dropped quickly, the ride seemingly never-ending. Black caverns flashed past, their circular openings marking the entrance to upper galleries. Pitt judged they had dropped well over a kilometer when the elevator began to slow and finally stopped. The operator opened the door, revealing a narrow, horizontal shaft leading off into the rock. The two guards escorted them to a heavy iron door. One of them took a key ring from his robe, selected a key, and turned the lock. Pitt and Giordino were pushed against the door so that it swung open. Inside was a much larger shaft with narrow rails laid on its floor. The guards closed the door and left them standing there. As a matter of routine, Giordino checked the door. It was a good 2 inches thick, and there was no handle on the inside, only a keyhole.
We won't be using this exit unless we can steal a key.
Not to be used by the hired help, said Pitt. For O'Banion and his cronies only.
Then we'll have to find another way. They obviously remove the ore through a different vertical shaft.
Pitt stared at the door thoughtfully.
No, I can't accept that. It's the executive elevator or nothing.
Before Giordino could reply, the whirring of an electric motor and the clanking sound of steel wheels against the rails came from one end of the shaft. A small generator-driven locomotive, pulling a long train of empty ore cars, appeared and slowed to a stop. A black woman climbed down from the driver's seat and confronted the two men. Pitt had never laid eyes on a woman with a body that was almost as wide as it was tall. She was, he decided, the ugliest woman he had ever laid eyes on. She'd have made a fitting gargoyle, he thought, on the eaves of a medieval cathedral. A heavy leather thong extended from her hand as if it had grown there. Without a word, she stepped up to Pitt.
I am Melica, foreman of the mines. I am to be obeyed and never questioned. Do you understand?
Pitt smiled. A new experience, taking orders from someone who resembles a toad with a weight problem. He saw the thong whipping through the air, but too late to duck or ward off the blow. It caught him high on the side of the face, and he saw stars in front of his eyes as he staggered back against the shoring timber. The blow struck with such force he came within a speck of blacking out.
"Seems as though everyone is hitting on me today," Pitt said thickly through the agony. "A short lesson on discipline," she snapped.
Then, in a lightning movement, incredibly swift for someone of her heavy build, she swung the thong backhanded toward Giordino's head. But she wasn't fast enough. Unlike Pitt, he had warning. He grasped her wrist in an iron grip, stopping the thong in midair. Slowly, as if in a test of wills, the two arms trembled as their muscles exerted every pressure at their command. Melika had the strength of an ox. She had never imagined that any man could have been capable of gripping her so hard. Surprise showed in her widened eyes, then disbelief, then anger. With his other hand, Giordino tore the thong from her grasp as one would snatch a stick from a snarling dog and hurled it into an ore car.
"You dirty scum!" she hissed. "You'll suffer for this!"
Giordino puckered up his lips and blew her a kiss. Love-hate relationships are the best. His cockiness cost him. He missed the sudden shift of the eyes, the foot lifting off the ground as the knee bent and thrust into his groin. Giordino released his grip on her wrist, dropped to his knees, and fell to his side, writhing in silent agony. Melika smiled satanically.
"You fools have condemned yourselves to a hell you can't imagine."
She wasted no more time with talk. She retrieved the thong and waved it toward an empty ore car and said the single word, "In." 5 minutes later, the train of ore cars stopped and then backed into a shaft. Lights strung along the timber trailed into the dark shadows. It looked to be a new working. Men's voices traveled over the noise of the train, and a moment later the gleam of their lamps flickered around a bend. They were herded along by Tuareg guards with whips and guns, chanting in tired, hoarse voices. All were Africans, some southern tribesmen, some desert people. Zombies in old horror movies looked in better health than these poor dregs. They moved slowly, dragging their feet. Most were dressed only in ragged shorts. Sweat covered their bodies that were also heavily coated with rock dust. The glazed look in their eyes and the ribs showing through their chests told of a starvation diet. All were scarred by lash marks, and a number of them were missing fingers. A few had dirty bandages around the stumps that once were attached to hands. Their weak chanting faded as the light from their lamps was lost around the next bend. The tracks ended at a pile of rock that had been blasted by the explosive crew they had passed in the shaft. Melika unhitched the locomotive. "Out!" she ordered. Pitt helped Giordino climb over the bucket edge of the car and half-supported him as they stood staring ferociously at the barrel-shaped slave driver. Her huge lips spread in a Novocaine grin. "You'll soon look like those scum." "You should pass out vitamins and steel gloves," said Giordino, suddenly straightening, his face pale with pain. Melika raised her thong and slashed him across the chest. Giordino did not blink or flinch. These men weren't yet cowed, she thought. It was only a question of days before she reduced them to animals. "The blasting crew has accidents," she said matter-of-factly. "Lost limbs go with the job."
"Remind me not to volunteer," muttered Pitt.
"Load this rock into the cars. When you've finished, you can eat and sleep. A guard will make his rounds at unannounced times. He finds you sleeping, you work extra shifts."
Pitt hesitated. A question was on the tip of his tongue, but it was stuck in his throat. It was time to lay low. He and Giordino stared at the tons of ore piled at the end of the shaft and then at each other. It seemed a hopeless, back-breaking task for two men to accomplish in less than 48 hours while hampered by shackles. Melika climbed onto the electric locomotive and nodded at a TV camera mounted on a crossbeam.
"Don't waste your time thinking of escape. You're under constant surveillance. Only two men made it out of the mines. Their bones were found by nomads."
She gave off a witch's cackle and rode off down the mine shaft. They watched until she had disappeared and all sounds faded. Then Giordino raised his hands and let them drop to his sides. "I think we've been had," he muttered as he sadly counted up to 35 empty ore cars. Pitt lifted the chain attached between his hand and ankle manacles and hobbled over to a large stack of beams, waiting to shore up the tunnel as it was excavated. He paced off one beam and did the same with an ore car. Then he nodded. "We should be able to wrap this up in 6 hours." Giordino gave him a very sour look indeed. "If you believe that, you'd better sign up for a course in elementary physics." "A little trick I learned picking raspberries one summer in high school," said Pitt curtly. "I hope it fools the surveillance camera," Giordino groaned. Pitt grinned insidiously. "Watch and learn."